So let me tell you just a little bit about myself. As you heard this morning, I'm an attorney and a certified financial planner. When I left the bank on April Fool's Day, 1989, and set up my own office, I was really worried about keeping a flow of client business, which is probably a concern for all of us, right? This was back in the early primitive days, and I bought a slideshow from Emerald Publications in San Diego. I think they're still in business. It was actually the little slides with the cardboard squares and the little carousel thing. I mean, I'm dating myself. And I just ran an ad in the paper and got a room at the library and had a morning session, an afternoon session, evening session. That was back in the day when information was valuable. I don't think it's very valuable today because it's free on the internet. So people were anxious to get information. So they would come in and I'd present it, and it was about living trust mostly, which was a new concept then. had pretty good results. About 90 days after I bought the program, a customer service person from Emerald called me and said, we're just checking up to see how that system's working for you. I said, doing great as far as I can tell. She asked, are you keeping track of your results? I said, yeah. What are they? Well, we're doing about 90%. 90%, that's incredible. So you're saying that if you do a workshop and they come in for a free consultation, 90% of those people who come for the consultation become your clients? I said, oh, no, I misunderstood the question. If I can get them in the workshop, 90% of them are going to become my clients. She said, we've never heard results like that. How is that? You know, what are you doing? Because other people who use this system aren't doing that. I said, I don't know. There's a term for me, an unconscious competent. So that means somebody who is good but doesn't know why they're good. There's a problem with being an unconscious competent. Well, actually, there's two problems. One is you don't know how to get better because you don't know why it's working. And number two, you can't share it with anybody else because you don't know why it's working. So I went on being very successful but unconsciously competent for a lot of years. In 1998, I moved to Orlando and ran into a fellow named Richard Stone, who I quoted this morning. He had a business called Storywork Institute. His job was helping business owners take their story and help infuse that into their client service, into their culture, and so forth. He had a problem, which was that he couldn't turn enough prospects into customers. And he heard that I had a pretty amazing skill at this, and he said, do you mind if I just sit in on one of your new prospect engagements to see what you're doing? I said, sure, you know, just be quiet. Let me get the client's permission for that, which they agreed to. And at the end, he was like jumping up and down. He said, Scott, I know what you're doing. I know why what you're doing is working. I said, well, tell me, because I've wondered all these years. He said, you're a storyteller. Your engagement meeting is all about a series of stories. He said, now, some of them are not sort of like classic stories, like there's this whole movement of storytelling as a performance. And he said, some of what you do wouldn't really pass for that, but they are narrative nonetheless. And what I find intriguing is you have several different types of stories that you use at different parts of this process. And, you know, that was a real breakthrough for me. I realized, oh, I'm telling stories, a variety of stories in a certain pattern, and the result is, and I thought back on it, oh, what I'm doing at those workshops was telling stories and engaging people, making friends with them, and then when they come to talk about working together, then I have an engagement sequence that I use. So that became a real breakthrough for me to understand why it was working, to polish the process, to start teaching the process. So what I'm going to share with you is what I've been using for lots of years and what I've been teaching for about a dozen years since I had that conversation with Richard Stone. One of the principles that I believe is very important is this. Abraham Lincoln said, if you can't make a living from your friends, you sure can't make a living from your enemies. Everyone who is going to become your customer needs to become your friend. And this is not to suggest that we're somehow going to take advantage of the friendship. No, this is to say that we will, in the process of talking about whether we work together, become friends, or we probably won't work together. It's just as simple as that. I believe that three things kind of underpin what I'm going to teach you today. To make a sale, you must turn a stranger into a friend. Friendships are based on a common story of a shared future. Now, let me explain that one just a little bit. If you have any kind of relationship with anybody, whether it's in your family, in your church, in your neighborhood, in business, it's because the two of you see that there's something about your future together that is better than your future apart. People say, well, no, relationships are all about history. No, relationships are all about the future. And you can take a marriage, for example. You can have 50 years of relationship in history, but if you don't see a positive future going forward, the marriage is over. The same is true in business. You could have had the most wonderful, faithful, perfect in every way customer, but if they don't see some advantage of being a part of your world in the future, then they're going to drift away. And so turning a prospect into a customer is helping them imagine a future in which the two of you are working together, and it is to their advantage, and it is also to your advantage. And so any sales process you go through must do these two things. It must turn someone into a friend. They must like you. They must want to be around you. And second, they must see that the future with you is better than the future without you. And then the third thing is that you can do this, you can do both of these things by understanding how stories work. If you understand the process of creating a story and of building a future story together, then you see how you become valuable to them, how they become your client. Any questions about this? I want this to be more of a give and take than that this morning. Anybody have any thoughts or observations about these 3 points? No? All right. So that's an amen from the front row. We appreciate that. Here's what I know about story, and this is a marvelous little poem. I've heard it quoted by Steve Sabo, but it was really from an American or Native American proverb. Tell me a fact and I will learn. Tell me a truth and I will believe. Tell me a story and it will live in my heart forever. There is something different about the way stories come to us and affect us, different from any other form of communication. And so when we grasp the power of this communication tool, stories, we open up a door that creates a number of opportunities for us. Those of you who are just coming in, there are some handouts that are down here lower if you are brave enough to take a few more steps in the dark. Here are 10 things that I know about stories, 10 ways in which they will affect your client relationships. Number one, stories are the reality we live in, and I talked about that this morning, that couple from Mississippi who had gone through the hurricane. I'll say it again in a somewhat different way. The world we live in is not what actually happened to us, but the stories we tell and repeat about what happened to us. And it's also true looking the other direction. The future is not what is actually going to happen to us. In fact, we don't know what is going to happen to us. The future, as we live it, is what we imagine will happen to us. It is the story we carry around in our own heads about what the future will be. Call it faith and hope or any other name you want to put on it. How we see the future unfolding, that story, determines how we live our lives. Number two, stories are a native language. It is how we made sense of the world from the time we had any sense at all, and it really is our core of what we value and the principles that we esteem. Stories affect us physically, mentally, and emotionally. I'd like to tell you of an experiment that was done in a Chicago hospital some years ago. They had heart patients who came in the night before to receive an open heart procedure. And they divided the group into four random groups. Group number one was given the typical hospital check-in experience. You know, go through all the paperwork, here's your room, what do you need? You need another pillow, whatever. You're going to have heart surgery in the morning. So that was the control group. They got no additional attention. Group number two, they had a volunteer who was trained after they got settled in their room to come in and just have conversation. I call that the chit-chat group. Number three, they had a volunteer who was trained to come in and ask the patient to tell them stories of happy times from their life. So the happy story group. And fourth, they had a volunteer who came in and engaged the patient in telling them stories of difficult times overcome during their life. So the challenges met and overcome group. So everybody got the four groups. The control group, we got the standard hospital experience. Second group, we got the chit-chat with the volunteer. Third group, who got the happy stories with the volunteer. Fourth group, who got the difficult times overcome conversation. Then they tested for five measures. They asked the physician, and all of them got the same procedure, how well did the surgery go? So measured by the physician, how well was it? Number two, how quickly were they able to get up and walk? Number three, how quickly were they able to go home? Number four, what was the long-term success of the operation? Number five, how did they report the hospital experience in terms of customer satisfaction on a subsequent survey? So four of the measures had to do with the physical results. Was the surgery a success? Were they able to get up and walk? Were they able to go home? Was it successful long-term in solving their medical problem? And fifth, how do they rate the experience? So I'm going to throw that question out to you. What do you think that study found with respect to those four groups and those five measures? Yes. No, that's the group four is the difficult experiences but overcome. Group three was the happy stories. Okay, so he's going to say group three, happy stories. Up there? You think it's four people had difficult times overcome? Okay. Any other possible choices? Okay, who votes with the gentleman down on the bottom? Who votes with the lady at the top? Okay. Well, here's the results. Turns out that groups one and two were effectively the same. Turns out that groups three and four were actually the same. But as between one and two and three and four, there was a huge difference. So those who got the typical hospital experience or those who got the chit-chat, the surgeries were less effective immediately. They took longer to get up and walk. They took longer to go home. The surgeries were less effective long-term, and they reported not as positive an experience being in the hospital. Three and four were essentially identical. There was not much difference between happy story and difficult experiences overcome stories. But as between the two groups, there's a huge gulf. Now, what does that study tell you about story? Yes?
Well, I think stories kind of affect not only just our mental, but also our physical health.
Exactly. You put your finger right on it. That's mind-boggling to me. The quality of the medical care, the results of the medical care were changed by their experience telling stories. And it's not just that they felt better. Now, that's an important lesson. They felt better about their experience. If you're into creating great customer experiences, but they actually got up and walked sooner. Come on. They left the hospital sooner. Come on. The doctor said it went better. I mean, that is really something to think about. So there's a profound thing going on here that I don't think we fully comprehend. We get so caught up in the numbers in our worlds that we fail to recognize that we can change how things feel physically to our clients. Number four, stories help us prepare for the future. So as we anticipate what's going to happen, we create a story around it, and then we make that story come about. Number five, stories uncover real worries and values. As we talk to clients and we get them talking about where they've come from, that past story, and where they're going, that future story, those worries and problems that we've been hearing about today are going to show up for them. Number six, stories help us teach more powerfully. I'm going to show you an example of that during this hour. Number seven, stories make the complex simple and understandable. We deal in a very complicated world. The things we know and understand are mysteries to most of the people we deal with. If we can learn to tell stories about what it is we do and the results of what we provide, they're going to get it, far more than trying to explain it in your financial planner ease or legalese. Stories make the distant and abstract tangible and immediate. In other words, something that we might worry about, my family won't have enough money if I died without insurance. A good story can make that come right home and can hit them right there. Remember, there's a physical impact of a good story. Stories warn us of dangers, and stories allow us to address the intuitive side of the brain. Sir, I keep repeating that there are handouts down here lower if you'd like some handouts. Let me talk about this number 10 a little bit. All of us have two functions going on inside our heads. I call them Mr. Analytical and Mr. Intuitive. In the old days, when they used to do hemispherical lobotomies, they determined that the right brain does one thing and the left brain does another. The left brain is more analytical, it's more numerical. The right brain is more creative, more artistic. Well, as they've gotten more sophisticated in their study of brain geography, they've learned that those functions are not purely on the left side or the right side, but that nomenclature continues. So Mr. Analytical is left brain. Mr. Intuitive is right brain. Now, here's what's important to understand about selling. Which side of the brain you're talking to is going to matter greatly, because Mr. Analytical approaches problems and receives information very differently than Mr. Intuitive. Let's talk about Mr. Analytical. He responds to numbers. He can never get enough of math. He needs concrete examples. He likes something he can sort of get his hands on. He likes breaking things into pieces. He's like the kid who understands how a watch works. How? By taking the watch apart, seeing all the little parts and pieces. He never gets enough information. Have you ever tried selling to Mr. Analytical? I have. How successful were you? Probably not so much. Why can Mr. Analytical never get enough information? Well, engineers tend to fall heavily into this category. Now, the truth is, we all have both of these going on. Even engineers have a little bit of Mr. Intuitive, but they're largely focused on that side of the brain. Albert Einstein explained this problem this way. He said, if you take everything you know and put a circle around it, so we're graphing what's inside of our brain in the form of a circle. What does the perimeter of the circle represent? It's the interface of all the things we don't know, correct? All right, so here's our circle. What if we give Mr. Analytical more information, thereby extending the circle? Everything that he knows now magnifies all the things that he doesn't know. And so as a result, there's never any way for him to get enough. The result is, the more information he gets, the more he tends to procrastinate. You give him, you analyze this, he needs that. You analyze that, he needs more of this. He demands detailed certainty, which in our world is impossible to produce. We don't know what the stock market's going to be doing 5 years from now. We don't even know what it's going to be doing tomorrow. We don't know how long you're going to live. All these things are impossible to know. So as a result, he locks up. He experiences what I call analysis paralysis. So what are your odds of being successful in trying to sell to Mr. Analytical? Probably not very high. Mr. Intuitive, on the other hand, responds to images. He likes word pictures. He likes stories. He can imagine the future. He's okay with what he doesn't know because he figures things out by putting pieces together. And if there's a gap, if you know he sees this line, there's no data for here, but it goes that way, he's able to fill in the gaps. As a result, since he's comfortable with what he feels, he gets a gut feeling and is able to go with it. He takes a leap of faith and decides and moves forward. So if you're selling, who do you want to be talking to? Pretty obvious. Well, the answer isn't that simple. If you're selling, you really have to engage both sides, and I'll explain that in the second hour. I'll explain why buyer's remorse happens, and you must understand this principle to know why it happens and what to do about it. The other thing, and this was mentioned in the presentation right before lunch, is the importance of a process. Many smart people, and I deal with lawyers, financial advisors, people who work in very high-end planning, philanthropic professionals, very, very smart. Very often when they sit down with a new client, they feel like they're smart enough to just wing it, to sell by the seat of their pants. I'm telling you that not only should you sell with a process, you have to deliver your service with a process. And one of the most valuable things you can bring to the table is a process. So if you don't get this, you're going to have far less results in turning prospects into clients. This is the process I'd like to share with you. And this hour, we're going to get down through the worry story and the hidden waterfall story. But here's what you need to understand. This is a process. You can repeat it every time. It doesn't take a long time, believe it or not, maybe 30 minutes at most. And the success is really, you can almost just count on it. Okay, I need to ask you a question. What is a chimpanzee's favorite food? Banana. If you said that, you're right. I have a harder question. What's a chimpanzee's second favorite food? Yes? Well, but if he had a choice, what would it be? Lettuce? Somebody has read the notes. Smart girl up there, you better listen to her. In fact, it is lettuce. Now, nobody guesses that. I was teaching this program in Denver one day, and somebody about where you're sitting up there said, yeah, it's lettuce. I said, how do you know that? Oh, I used to raise chimps. Said, how much do they like lettuce compared to bananas? Said, it's just about even. In fact, it's not like 70-30 or 60-40. It's like 51-49. They will take lettuce almost as often as they'll take bananas. So a group of zoologists conducted what I thought was just an ingenious experiment. They had two groups of chimps in essentially the same situation. Group one, they were in a room. There was a cage outside the room. The zookeeper took a wooden box, and he put bunches of lettuce under the box. They opened the door to the room. They went out into the cage. They found the box. They turned it up. They found lettuce, their second favorite food. How do you suppose they behaved? What? They ate it. They were very happy. I mean, if you came upon just this big pile of your second favorite food, wouldn't you be happy? They were. Group two, same setting, one slight difference. Between the room and the cage, there was a window. They could see out the window. The zookeeper took a box, and under the box he put bananas. Then they closed the curtain so they could not see out the window, and he took out the bananas and put lettuce under the box. They opened the door. They came around to the cage. They found the box. They turned it up. They found lettuce, their second favorite food. How do you suppose they behaved? They didn't eat it? It was worse than that. They went crazy. I've had people say they went ape. They went bananas. They were stamping and shrieking and tearing the lettuce and jumping on it. They weren't about to eat it. Now, understand, this is not something they hate. This is something they love. So what's the difference? Yeah. Exactly. So to the degree that we can extrapolate from chimp behavior to human behavior, what's the takeaway from this little experiment? Don't bait and switch, yeah? Which is another way of saying you better manage your expectations, right? I think I just heard that right before lunch. If you don't manage their expectations in the meeting and in the overall service, you're going to have an unhappy customer, or you're likely not to have a customer. And so when I sit down with a new prospect, the first thing that I want to do after we get the pleasantries out of the way, you know, everything fine, do you need a Coke? I want to make sure that we both are on the same page about what's going to happen today. And so the banana lettuce story is really my describing how I'm envisioning this meeting to go and checking with the client, or in this case, he's still a prospect, to find out if that is consistent with what he has in mind. And if he has different expectations, then we have to make sure that we mesh those expectations. So what happens if you arrive at the meeting with a very different set of expectations than what the client comes with? What's going to happen with that meeting, likely? You're going to have a lettuce banana experience, just like those chimpanzees. And so when we first sit down in an engagement meeting, a sales meeting, call it what you like, we want to make sure that everything is that we're in concurrence. So I've set aside, you know, 45 minutes to an hour for this meeting. Does that fit your schedule? What I'd like to do is give you a little bit of background on me. I want to hear a lot about you. I want to hear what your concerns are, because most people who sit down with me typically have something on their mind. I want to explore what those concerns might lead to, if they were taken care of or not. I will describe how we help people like you. I will talk about how I get paid. And then I'll make sure that every question you have has been resolved. Does that fit your vision of what we were going to do today? You say, well, I want to make sure we talk about this or that. Okay, we'll put it in right here. So we reach an upfront understanding about what today's going to look like, and that way there are no surprises going forward. So that's what we call the banana lettuce story. It's where we start every engagement meeting. I would suggest it's probably a great tool that you could start every meeting. I've been to lots of meetings where church meetings, those are probably the worst, where it wasn't clear what we were supposed to be doing here, and, you know, it was just miserable. I like what Boyd K. Packer says, you know, it takes a mighty good meeting to be better than no meeting. Make sure that your meetings are always better than no meeting. So the banana lettuce story allows you to meet them where they are, to manage their expectations about what's going to happen. Now, this material is explained in more detail in this book called Double Your Sales, An Honest and Authentic Approach to Professional Selling. One of the students in my classes, financial advisor, said, Scott, you know, the things you teach are just stupidly simple and duh obvious. And I said, thank you. I said, but they work. So a lot of what you're going to hear is stuff you already know, but maybe you haven't turned it into a system. You haven't turned it into a process. We all know this. You got to make sure that everybody's expecting the same thing as they sit through this meeting. The next step is what we call the new me story. The new me story is you making a 2.5 or 3 minute introduction of yourself in a way that says lots of things, but most importantly, I deserve to be at this table. And not only that, I'm better than everyone you've ever talked to who might have been at this table. And we do that with a short and simple story about ourselves. Does anybody who studied literature or who's written a television program or a movie, can they tell us what the character arc is? What is the character arc? Well, it's sort of the classic model of all of our Western literature. At the beginning of the story, we get introduced to the protagonist. We learn something about him or her that makes them rather interesting to us. And then they run into a problem or a series of problems. And what makes the story interesting is how they come to deal with those problems. If they deal with them well, then we have a happy ending. If they fail to deal with them well, then we have a tragedy. But every good book, every good TV program or movie follows that pattern. Here's the character, we get to know them, then something happens unexpected. How do they deal with that? And how they deal with it turns out to decide the resolution. Well, we do a very little simple version of that in front of the client. Now, I did that very thing with you today as I introduced this program. Let's go back to my introduction. I did the same thing this morning as I introduced myself there. So using the one we just did today, so I bought the Emerald Publication presentation. And what was fascinating about that to you? Well, I was trying to sell financial services and products. I had an amazing success. But what was my problem? I was an unconscious competent. I didn't know what to do with whatever I was doing. Finally, I ran into a solution in the form of Rick Stone, and he created that aha. And so from that, I was able to take this process that I've been using for a decade and tweak it and make it something that was I could actually share and I could make it better. And so the old me was an unconscious competent. I was successful, but I didn't know why. And dealing with that unconscious competentness, is that a word? Left me sort of stymied. What am I going to do with this? And then finally, I had a great response. I turned out to have something valuable to you. Now, here's why this works. The new me story introduces you in a way that makes you credible. So in the first part of the story, if I go back to the first step, when you talk about the old me, you're going to be someone who's worthy of being in this process, someone who deserves to be at the table. Here's a secret I've learned about stories. You can put all sorts of stuff about yourself in the story that is accepted by the client that you can never just come right out and tell you. It's kind of weird. So if I just said, oh, I closed 90% of all my cases, you would say, what a braggadocio, I don't want to listen to him. But if I narrate a story and say, you know, I was doing these workshops, and the lady called me and says, what kind of results you're getting? And I said, 90%. Whoa. Well, for some reason, the brain receives those two pieces of information, though it's the same information, very differently. One's coming from the left side, the analytical. One's coming into the right side, the story. And for some reason, we accept it. It humanizes you. See, when you run into problems and you have to change to deal with that new situation, it makes you more human. I have to tell you a secret. A perhaps unhappy secret. You are not seen as human by your customers because you got too many numbers in your head and too many letters behind your names. If we're going to be friends with these people, we have to become human to these people. And so this story about you, where you had to deal with an issue, you know, perfect people, Superman never has any problems, but real people have problems and they have to figure out ways around it. That's what we want them to hear. I'm a real person. I had a problem. I had a struggle with this thing. Some of my struggles weren't exactly pretty, But in the long run, it helped me be a better person. It distinguishes you. So this transformation that you undergo in the course of this brief little story says to them, boy, she has become different than all those other people out there. He's bringing something to the table that I've never seen before. That transformation that occurs in the course of this story makes you stand out from the whole crowd. It also sets an example of storytelling. It says it's okay for us to share stories here because we want this whole interaction to be about sharing stories. It moves the conversation to the intuitive side of the brain because that's the story listening side. And why is that important? Well, here's one thing I know for sure from being in this business for over 30 years. Every major decision we make in our lives is made intuitively first, and that it is justified analytically second. Think about every major decision you've ever made in your life. Where you went to school, who you married, what career you went into, what house you bought, what was your most recent new car. If you actually looked at that carefully, you'd see you had a feeling, an intuitive sense, a gut feeling, and you went with that, and then you went back and you found reasons why that was the right thing to do. That's what's going to happen in this sales process. They're going to feel whether they're going to work with you long before their head says it's okay. And if you don't get their thinking on the right side, they're never going to be able to process all of that analytical stuff. Remember, Mr. Intuitive says yes, Mr. Analytical says, hey buddy, be careful. We want Mr. Yes to be at the table. It also invites them to change in a very subtle way. I've changed. You're invited to change as well. The next step is what we call the Who Are You story. Now, this is something all of you already do. You just don't have a name for it. You just don't think of it and have it built into your process. It's, okay, tell me about yourself. Where did you come from? How'd you end up here? How'd you two get together? How'd you end up living in this neighborhood? Why did you choose that line of work? All the things that you know how to do. Asking them to tell about themselves. In the course of this particular interaction, I think of this as a three-part process. Number one, just who are you generally? You know, how'd you end up on the planet? How'd you end up here? How'd you end up together? How do you end up doing what you do? And most people are quite interested in talking about themselves, and especially if you've shown them a pattern that we're going to share stories here. Second thing that I want to know in this Who Are You story is, what experience have you had working in this world that we're talking about? If I'm coming from my attorney, have my attorney hat on, I want to know if they've had a lousy experience with some attorney. You're going to want to know, if you're on the insurance side of things, have they ever felt like they've been burned with an insurance agent or somebody in their family? You got to know those background stories. And so, number one, who are you as a person? Number two, what has been your experience in this world we're talking about? And number three, what brought you here today? What induced you to say, yeah, come on over and I'll give you 30 minutes of my time? Something is on their mind, otherwise they wouldn't give you the time of day. You know, talking with us is not something people wake up in the morning and say, oh yeah, I want to go do that. You know, we're more like the root canal as opposed to, you know, winning the lottery. So the Who Are You story guides them to share with you who they are, what their experiences are in this field, and why they're here today. Now, that's just a natural conversation that I say all of you do all the time. You just may not be as intentional about it as I'm suggesting you ought to be. See, most of us have a couple of really great sort of leading questions. They're almost like cocktail parties. Well, I guess you don't do cocktail parties here in this part of the world. Where I'm from, you go to cocktail parties. And everybody has sort of their cocktail party questions. And you just put one out there and people start chatting about it and away you go. The next step is for them to tell you what they're worried about. If they don't have worries or problems or whatever your term is for that, as we heard this morning, you make a living not by solving your problems, but by solving their problems. But here's the problem with that. If they don't see it as a problem, they're not going to pay you to solve it. And so in this part of the process, we have to make sure that they are able to articulate what it is that's bugging them. As I said, for most cases, they wouldn't have spent the time to talk to you in the first place unless they had something that was bugging them. So we have to gently ask them to share what that is. Or we have to have a way of sort of going through like a checklist. So some of the people that I talk with are worried about this or that. Is that something that worries you as well? I teach people, professionals like you, others, to make a list of 10 or 12 things, 10 or 12 problems that you can fix. There's something really empowering about seeing it on paper. These are the things I can help you with. When most people do that activity, it's like an ego boost to realize, wow, I really do have a repertoire of issues that I can help people address. And so in the worry story, they are telling you what they are worried about. And we have a rule for this step and some of the other steps. It doesn't count if you say it. It only counts if they say it. You can tell them that they need more insurance until you're blue in the face. You can tell them that they're going to have a terrible situation if they become disabled and they're not covered until you're blue in the face. It won't do any good unless they say it. And so we have to be able to very gently and elegantly inquire, is that something you're worried about? If they can't put their finger on a problem, then we've got a problem. Because if they don't have a problem that they recognize, we don't get paid. We only get paid for solving problems that they appreciate. They have to see it as a problem, and they have to believe that we can solve the problem, and they have to believe in the solution that we're going to bring to the table. If that doesn't happen, then we don't have a customer. It's really as simple as that. So what I teach people to do is to go home and get out a sheet of paper and start making a list of some of the problems that you can fix. And you're going to be impressed with yourself. It's going to be very handy to know exactly what it is you can do so that those are the things you start looking for. One of the organizations that I've worked with a lot, it's called the National Network of Estate Planning Attorneys, uses a process they call the spots on the X-ray. And they've identified 10 or 12 issues that their members are qualified to help with, and they lead into a conversation. You know, if you went and had yourself scanned, got some X-rays, then the doctor may look at that and see these, that looks funny. There's a dark spot there. We better check into that. And so here are some of the issues, the spots on the X-ray that many of our clients come to us for. Is that something you're concerned about? Now, sometimes people don't know what they don't know. I guess always we don't know what we don't know. They don't know the problems that they really face. Sometimes they know they have a problem, but they don't want to own it. I'm sure you've run into some of those. What happens when you have a client or a prospective client who is unable to own their problem? I'll talk about that in just a second. So the worry story, they identify and articulate concerns that you can help them address. They may not describe it in the same words you do. They'll describe it in their way of looking at it. Your job is to help them say, yes, that's something I should be taking care of. And so what if they don't? Because they don't know they have a problem, or they're just stubborn, they don't want to own the problem. Well, we have another little tool that we call the hidden waterfall story. Now, like the banana lettuce, this is a metaphor for an approach. So people ask me all the time, well, so do I tell the client the banana lettuce story at the beginning of the meeting? Oh, no. That's just code to you to say you better make sure that what you're offering is what they're expecting. And so you need to have a process, you need to have a little narrative to describe that. Same is true with the Hidden Waterfall story. So here's the story that's behind that. So I am a guide on a beautiful river down in Florida. We say it's the Suwannee River. And we're kind of cruising along that Suwannee River on some kayaks, and it's beautiful there. And all of a sudden I say, you know, folks, we need to get over to the right bank right away. Hurry, hurry. And you say, but we can't see the scenery from over there. We're going to be under the trees. I want to stay out here in the middle of the river. Why should I go to the right bank? And I say, well, I've been down this river lots of times. And about 100 yards around the next curve is a 75-foot waterfall. And as we get closer, the current gets very, very swift. If you're not over by the right bank, by the time we get close there, you're going to be swept over that waterfall to serious injury or death. So now, how about let's get over to the right bank? Oh, in that case, I get it. So the Hidden Waterfall story is a story about somebody who had a problem. One of the same problems that you believe they have, but who didn't take care of it. And these Hidden Waterfall stories tend to come in three categories. Let's see. If you've had your own client experience with somebody who had a problem and didn't take care of it and as a result got burned, that's a great story. You can also borrow stories from your colleagues, and that's one advantage of coming to programs like this, is over lunch or dinner or in the breaks, whatever, you can learn what other people have done. You can learn about people they've worked with who screwed up. And then the third source of these Hidden Waterfall stories are famous people. You know, people they know who didn't take care of their business and ended up really screwing themselves or somebody they loved. Some of you probably know some of those stories. Can you think of any right off the top of your head? You know, back when I was giving those Living Trust workshops, I used the story of Groucho Marx, who didn't set up a plan for someone to care for him in case of his disability. And so his live-in girlfriend and his children had this knockdown, drag-out fight that was in all the courts because over who's going to take care of Groucho in his last years. Some of you football fans may remember Joe Robbie, used to own the Miami Dolphins, didn't plan, ended up selling not only the team but the stadium that used to bear his name so his family could have money for taxes. So whatever your set of issues are, and it goes back to that list of 10 or 12 things that you can fix, you need to have a good story that convinces people you can't leave this issue untended, because if you do, you're going to end up getting burned in the long run. And so we tell that story about somebody else who screwed up. Oh, let me say one more thing about this. There's something very powerful about famous people. It's either a voyeuristic attitude, we love to see famous people, you know, at their worst, or we like it that they kind of get their due. So those tend to be very powerful. So if you're reading a book or hearing stories, go to a conference and hear about somebody who screwed up in a major way, somebody famous, and it's one of your issues, one of your solutions, capture that story and learn how to tell it. So we tell that story, and so you see Mr. Robbie, who had everything, ended up losing it all because he didn't plan for the taxes. Now, do you think that could be an issue we should be talking about together? So we very gently raise the subject. Do you think you ought to pay some more attention to estate tax planning? And usually they'll say, I never thought of that. The story is very powerful for them to realize that they've got a problem. Now, why do you think it's more effective to tell them about the problem they have in the form of this story than it is to come right out and say, Mr. Smith, you've got an estate tax problem? What happens when you sort of stick it in their face? They push back. Yeah, it becomes adversarial. And they'll bow their necks and okay, they'll kick you out. I found that if you tell the story of somebody else who screwed up and invite them to see themselves in the story, they'll jump right on it 99% of the time. And so this hidden waterfall story is a great way to make sure that you can put enough worries on the table. As we learned this morning, you only get paid for fixing their problems. And I would amplify that by saying their problems that they recognize and realize they need help with. So, something he doesn't understand. It's also a great way of teaching. Many of the things we understand are beyond the understanding or beyond the experience of our prospective clients. We have to teach them this is something you ought to worry about. In the world I work with, very high net worth families, most of them aren't really aware of how much damage their money can do to their kids. All it takes is for me to tell a little story about Paris Hilton and draw them into that story, and they start to get it. I can just say those two words, and most of you get it, right? Most of them get it. So that's an example, a very simple example, of a hidden waterfall story. Your money could end up damaging your children if we don't take some special steps to prepare him or her for what's going to land in their laps at some point in their lives. We're working with a client family now in New Jersey. The guy was very successful, brought a company public. At age 40, it was worth $150 million. He's never told his children about the money. He set up trust back before it went public, and they're where they get about $5 million apiece when they're 35. He's come to us realizing that, ooh, if I don't get them ready, when that money drops in their lap, they're going to be ruined. So he gets the problem. It took a little Paris Hilton for him to understand he has the problem. Okay, so this is as much as that we're going to cover in this hour. It's almost 2 o'clock. Any questions or comments about any of the pieces we've covered so far? Yes, here's one.
In your book, can you go into more detail and further in this process?
Yes. In the book, each chapter, each of these stories is a chapter, and each chapter is about 10 or 12 pages long. So I give examples. Here's what that sounds like when you say it. And so, yeah, there's a lot of context and explanation and more details. Yes? Yes. Well, they have some for sale over there where you get the soda pop. If they're out, and we had a problem at the printers and the books are arriving on Monday, they have some forms there that you can just fill out and give to me, and I will ship you the book from Florida. So you can just bring that form back to me or leave it with the gal there, and we'll happy to do that. Or you can get the book online at wsalesnow.com. Thank you for the questions. Any others? Okay, the next round, we're going to talk about the rest of the process. I'm going to do a quick review for those who weren't here, and then I'll talk about the importance of your process, how to head off buyer's remorse, how to set up the next step, and so forth. We'll continue our way around that circle.